I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Did banks give false information to credit rating agencies in order to get better ratings on risky securities? That's the question at the heart of a new investigation of eight major banks launched by New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. But it's a question that's hard to pose with a straight face. The symbiotic relationship between ratings agencies and Wall Street banks has been called into question since the 1970s, when the agencies began being paid by the very banks whose instruments they rate. New York Times business reporter Louise Story is with us. And Louise, first of all, what is it that the banks are being investigated for? Is it for outright misrepresentation of what's in these securities they were having rated?
Well, the Attorney General is going to investigate whether they provided information to the banks that was misleading. You know, there were a number of these banks, including Goldman Sachs, that had a short position, a bet against housing on. And what he wants to look into is whether they knew that the things that they were putting in these deals should not have gotten the ratings that they got, and whether they turned in misleading information or manipulated the rating models to get a better rating than they should have gotten. This is important because, you know, investors relied on those ratings to decide whether to buy these mortgage bonds.
And let's just remind people, these mortgage bonds came about because middlemen would make millions by making mortgage loans, sometimes to homeowners who had no chance of ever paying them back. But these middlemen quickly turn around and sold these mortgages to banks, which bundled them, sometimes with safer mortgages. And then these bonds had to be rated by agencies like Moody's and S&P before being sold. Michael Lewis, who's going to be on our program tomorrow, whose book is The Big Short, he writes that these banks would sometimes just put together all the lousy loans, but tell the ratings agency, well, you know, it's diverse, it's safe, because it's from different states. You know, so is this the kind of thing they're being accused of doing?
The investigation is absolutely centered on the diversification of these bonds. So the mortgage bonds got a lot higher ratings if the rating agencies believed that the mortgages within them were all different, were from different parts of the country or had different servicers. And one of the things that the Attorney General is going to investigate is whether, when the banks filled out the forms, in some occasions if they put down a master servicer, for instance, for one bond versus a subservicer. There's usually two servicers involved to make it look like they were more diverse than they really were.
Right.
So that will be at the heart of the investigation.
Right. It's not exactly diverse if all the mortgages are from states that are having huge housing problems and tons of bad mortgages. Well, you write a big problem was the ratings agencies had drunk the Kool-Aid. They believed that the housing market could never fail, but also the revolving door of employees between the ratings agencies and the banks. Tell us about that.
That's right. I've talked to a number of rating agency workers, people who used to work there, who told me back in 04, 05, 06, the aspiration for so many of them was to get to a Wall Street bank. If they were a senior analyst at the rating agency, they might have been making $200,000 or $300,000, but a bank would come along and offer them $1 million. And so the question is, did they really scrutinize these deals harshly enough and push back on the banks when at the same moment some of them wanted a job at the banks?
Well, and even further, whether or not they came from rating agencies, people who worked at the banks really had a hand in how financial tools were designed. And we have emails that you report on that show that there were honest people at the ratings agencies who were frustrated by that.
People were very frustrated, and you can see that in these emails that have come out of a Senate committee. There was a lot of pressure put on the rating agency workers from the banks, and that'll be very much at the heart of this investigation, whether the banks just really ran the show for something that was supposed to be independent.
Well, Andrew Cuomo has scrutinized rating agencies before in 2008. There was a settlement, and the rating agencies agreed to demand more information on mortgage bonds. But, Louise Story, what do you think the possibility is now that there will be major changes? For instance, ending the pay structure that now exists where rating agencies are paid by the banks.
Well, you know, Cuomo got that pay structure changed somewhat in 08. It used to be that banks only paid the rating agencies if they selected them to rate their deals. And so the banks would kind of shop around and find a more favorable agency. Cuomo back in 08 got that changed so that the rating agencies get paid for their work, even if they're not selected, if they do any work on the deal. But the broader question that you raise is one I've heard from many people, which is, why do the banks pay the rating agencies at all? Perhaps investors should pay them.
Which is the way it used to be. New York Times business reporter Louise Story. Louise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced today that several people have been taken into custody in the failed Times Square car bombing after several raids here in the Northeast. Two people were reportedly taken into custody on alleged immigration violations in Watertown, Massachusetts. Meanwhile, Faisal Shahzad, the would-be Times Square bomber, is being held at an undisclosed location and has been talking with U.S. authorities. So, what is he saying? We know he was born in Pakistan, became a U.S. citizen a little over a year ago, often visited his home country, and claims to have trained there with the Pakistani Taliban. But why? The common wisdom post 9/11 was that immigrants to the U.S. were less likely to be radicalized than, say, in Britain, because in the U.S. it was far easier to assimilate, to feel a part of. But Fareed Zakaria writes in Newsweek that Shahzad was middle class, educated, and seemingly assimilated. Then something happened. What was it? Investigators are trying to answer that question. Was it the U.S. drone campaign in his native Pakistan? Was it online, or most alarmingly, are Taliban recruiters here in the U.S.? We want to spend a few minutes today on the process of Islamic radicalization with Gary Ackerman. He's with the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. It's an international organization, but he's based at the University of Maryland, where he's studying cases. Gary, let's start with Faisal Shahzad. Do we know why he went to train to make bombs in Pakistan?
Well, Robin, it's unclear exactly why he, or exactly what the drivers were. However, we do have some clues. We know something that his house was foreclosed on. We know that he stopped working. And we know that sometime around the middle of last year, he moved to Pakistan quite rapidly. There are two possible explanations of this. Unfortunately, the evidence points in both directions. The one explanation is that because of the crises in his life, as we see with many of those who are radicalized, it created a sort of cognitive opening or a crisis for him, and that drove him towards, you know, more radical elements and towards a more radical way of thinking. On the other hand, the other argument is that he was recruited specifically and he basically let everything in his life here fall apart because he knew he wouldn't have to rely on it anymore.
Well, so it's sort of a chicken and egg question right now, but do we know how he might have been recruited, whether or not it was before or after his life fell apart? There was speculation after his arrest that recruiters may be on the ground here in the U.S., as opposed to, let's say, the Yemeni cleric, who we know is connected with the Fort Hood shooter, but recruits actively online. What do you know about possibility of Taliban recruiters in particular being on the ground in the U.S.?
Most people, I think, are under the impression that there have not been that many recruiters actually physically in the United States, at least since 9/11. However, on the one hand, yes, we definitely find that Anwar al-Awlaki, who is the Yemeni-American cleric that you spoke of, he has been involved in several radicalization processes in the U.S., but he has done most of that, as far as we know, online in a virtual setting. However, we do have several cases of physical recruitment or physical facilitation of a radicalization process which occurred within the United States.
And one of the cases that you studied was that of Adam Gadan. He was born Adam Perlman. He eventually became a spokesperson for Al-Qaeda. But his conversion to Islam was to refute his father's liberal thinking. So it was more of an internal force. What about external forces on Faisal Shahzad? Let's go back to the would-be Times Square bomber. David Sanger writes in the New York Times that the Obama administration's thinking in Pakistan was to attack al-Qaeda but degrade the Taliban. The Taliban was a local insurgency. Now the White House is asking, have the drone strikes in Pakistan made Taliban insurgents think about attacking Times Square instead of just Kabul and using people like Shahzad? What do you see?
In terms of the Pakistani Taliban, which the main grouping within that is the TTP or Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, this group has traditionally not been fighting directly against U.S. interests or U.S. troops, and definitely has not been known previous to this to target the U.S. directly. Now, they have been, unfortunately, the Pakistani situation is highly complex. You have Al-Qaeda, you have the Afghan Taliban, and then you have the Pakistani Pakistani Taliban, which is not just one group. It's made up of numerous militant groups, and there's a lot of flow in between them. You have other militants like Lashkar-e-Taiba, etc., etc. So when we engage in a drone attack, and we might actually be targeting an al-Qaeda member, but we might end up killing several other members, senior members of some of these related organizations, including perhaps the TTP. Now, in the culture that predominates in the area, you know, revenge is a prominent element of the culture in this sort of clan, tribal atmosphere that predominates there. So Sanger makes a good hypothesis in that part of the reason why TTP are now looking towards the United States directly is because they're seeking revenge for drone attacks that have targeted them and their allies. Mm. However, that is something that might be, from the TTP's point of view, they might think to themselves, well, we have nothing to lose. They're attacking us anyway with drones, so we might as well attack them directly. At the same time, you have to ask yourself, well, what are the motivations for somebody like Faisal Shahzad? Because here is somebody who is, in essence, on his way, at least, if not living, but on his way to living the American dream, has an MBA, has a wife and children, and what seems like a quite comfortable situation in Connecticut, and yet he falls in. So now the question is, does he fall in with these folks, or is he recruited by TTP? Because if TTP have now targeted the United States, they'd be looking for Faisal Shahzad would be the perfect recruit for them. They'll be looking for somebody like him. So now the question is, did they reach out to him and start telling him, it's your duty, you look at what the US is doing to us, they're killing innocent Pakistanis, etc., etc., and you have to join the jihad? Or on the other hand, did he suffer a life crisis, reach out to people in Pakistan and tell them that his life was falling apart over here, and therefore those people in Pakistan saw this as a great opportunity to find a new recruit for the TTP? And it might be a mixture of both. It could be sort of one of those confluence of factors that just happen to be advantageous for a group that is seeking to attack the United States.
To that question of assimilation, as we said at the start, that the thinking was that we'd have fewer nationalized citizens who were born elsewhere and became U.S. Citizens because they could assimilate. What do you find?
Out of the 83 people that we studied that we actually know where they were born, only 22 of them, this is individuals in the United States who radicalized to a radical form of Islam while they were living in the United States. And out of the 83 people of whom we managed to track back their country of birth, only 22 were born in the United States. The remainder were from a variety of countries, including the Middle East, the Caribbean, and several other countries. So many of them were U.S. citizens, but as I said, only 22 out of, so only roughly a quarter of the population that we studied actually were born in the United States. So definitely the immigrant communities are targeted, and the immigrant communities are vulnerable to radicalization.
That's Gary Ackerman. He's at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. It's part of a huge international research study on radicalization. So when we come back, what's to be done with the research? Also, just take a second here to remind you, coming up later on Here and Now, Alex Beam, now a reporter, started out as a fact checker at the now foundering Newsweek magazine. He'll remember the good old days and some of the characters for us as that storied weekly is up for sale. And also, author Sue Miller's new novel centers around an unsettling thought. What if your boyfriend died on 9/11 and you were about to break up with him? But back in 1 minute, more with a look at terrorists and radicalization here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Gary Ackerman, Assistant Director for Research and Communication at the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. It's part of an international study, but Gary is based in College Park, Maryland, there with other researchers studying the process of Islamic radicalization. Cases in the U.S., like that of Zakaria Maroof, a Somali-American who was part of the first wave of more than 24 men who left the Minneapolis area to fight in Somalia's civil war. He reportedly then played a role in recruiting others to fight, though, in Somalia. Then there's Gregory Vernon Patterson, an African-American who was recruited by militants in prison in the U.S. and eventually charged in connection with an alleged plot to attack military facilities, synagogues, and other sites in the Los Angeles area. That was in 2005. So, Gary, you're looking at these different cases of homegrown terrorists. Other researchers doing the same thing in Europe. So, first of all, are you anticipating real differences between how radicalization recruitment works in Europe as opposed to the U.S.?
We're actually, that's one of the core elements of our research, is looking at the parallels and the differences between radicalization processes in the United States or in North America versus those in Europe. And, you know, there's a predominant, or at least there is one theory which states that because there's a number of differences in the structures and the ways of that assimilation occurs and immigration occurs in the different regions, we're going to get different processes of radicalization. And what has been thought of before, what a lot of people have put forward, is that, you know, generally immigrants tend to assimilate a lot easier and a lot quicker into American society and American culture versus Europe, where they often form ghettos, etc., etc. So it was viewed previously that radicalization, or at least the homegrown radicalization, so to speak, would be less of a problem in the United States. We are unfortunately seeing now that we have upwards of 130 cases of people being radicalized in the United States, that's not necessarily true. There are roughly the same amount of cases as there are in Europe. So one of the things that is clear, though, is that the so-called universal drivers or external drivers, this is people who are already connected to the transnational jihadist movement, those people do play a role in radicalizing people both in the United States and Canada and on the European side of the Atlantic.
Given that the picture that's coming into focus as you look at it is that most homegrown terrorists in the U.S. were born outside of the country and nationalized, although many were born in this country and radicalized sometimes without any recruitment from groups outside the U.S. Taking your research, how does the U.S. begin to combat homegrown terrorism?
I think there's a number of things we can do. There's measures that are obviously your traditional law enforcement measures that the Federal Bureau of Investigation and Homeland Security and various other parties are using. And this is, you know, your traditional measures like surveillance and relying on informants from within the community. And many existing plots have actually been wound up, you know, using these measures. But there's a new feeling that you should add to these measures. Those need to be retained and strengthened. But there's a feeling that you can take a lot of preventative measures. And this is in the communities themselves, getting the communities themselves at a grassroots level to A, be aware of the potential problem, the problem that their youth is getting radicalized, whether it's from inside or outside the community, and B, so that the community can provide alternative avenues for the youth who may be at risk of radicalization to to steer them away from this. And many of the techniques that people have looked at, they have said it has to come from the communities themselves. So, this can't be imposed by the federal government or even a local government. This has to come from inside the Muslim communities.
Gary, I just have to jump in to say, how does that address to Faisal Shahzad, who was an investment banker before his life went south? He did not live in a quote-unquote immigrant community. He lived in a community in Connecticut. Or Saeed Ahmed, who was sentenced in 2009 to prison, again, another naturalized American citizen, who was an undergrad at the Georgia Institute of Technology, majoring in mechanical engineering. You know, these were people who seemed assimilated.
In many of the cases, just an example in the Somali case, in many of the cases, the parents were completely oblivious to the people who went off, the young men who went off to the to fight in Somalia. Their parents were completely oblivious to what was going on, to the fact that they'd been radicalized, even though those young men lived at home. Now it's much better to, I think, an alternative is to get the communities to recognize the signs, just as there were these during the 80s and 90s. There was a lot of educational campaigns in making people aware of why their children might be or when their children might be using narcotics or when their children might be at risk of joining gangs. Very similar ideas. There are clear warning signs. There's also clear signs of something outsiders in moving into the community or people in the community that are causing problems in a particular mosque, for instance. So in many cases, we have a traditional mainstream mosque structure, and then somebody comes in, a young person comes in and sort of pulls a lot of the young people away from the mosque structure and starts radicalizing them. And that person is a usurper or an interloper in the traditional sort of mosque culture. And people know about this often, but I think in the past it often hasn't been drawn to the attention because it hasn't been viewed as serious enough. And I think that now we have several cases, we have numerous cases of where, you know, where people are sort of, the youth are siphoned off by something that looks more exciting, by recruiters that come in and espouse a outlook or a view or an ideology that's a lot more exciting. And I just want to say something very important here. We are distinguishing, making a very clear distinction between, you know, mainstream Islam, which you know, and what we call Islamism, and Islamism or jihadism is a radical form of, it's a radical political ideology which is anti-Western, and the jihadist form is a form of that which engages in violence. So I just want to make that clear for the listeners that, you know, we are not in any way tarring the entire Muslim community. It's just very what you call this, is the poison apples within the community that the community has to learn to recognize and expunge, or at least bring to the attention of authorities.
That's Gary Ackerman from the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. Gary, thanks so much. And we want to know what our listeners think. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us and send an email or leave a phone message, or scroll down and leave a comment right there. Again, the latest news today, the FBI says agents are searching several locations in the Northeast in connection with the failed Times Square bombing. More in the latest news here and now. Experts say militants in Iraq seem to be doing their best to bait their rivals into another sectarian war. Overnight, the latest in a series of car bombs went off in Baghdad's Sadr city, killing 9 people, including 3 suspected militants in the car that police say exploded prematurely. On Monday, 119 people were killed in coordinated attacks across 10 cities. Militants may be trying to take advantage of both a U.S. troop drawdown and the country's political uncertainty. 2 months after Iraqi parliamentary elections, there's still no new government, and it could take months more to form one. Gabriel Gatehouse of the BBC is in Baghdad. Gabriel, first of all, these bombings, what's going on? Who are the targets?
Well, if you look at Monday's bombings, it's really quite hard to say, because they struck really across Iraq, from Mosul in the north to Basra in the south, Fallujah in the west, and then across Baghdad, and very, very different targets, and I think quite bewildering, even for Iraqis who are, to some extent, used to this kind of violence.
Well, what's going on? And if I may, just I'll give a quick thumbnail here. We know that after the U.S.-led invasion, the majority Shia came back into power. The Sunnis stepped down. There's been this, you know, tension ever since. What's the sense that we're on the brink of sectarian war again?
There is a very real worry about this. What I don't get the impression of is that the sectarian tensions and high feelings are boiling over to the extent that we saw a few years ago.
Well, some would say that Ahmed Chalabi is doing his best to try to reignite it. Ahmed Chalabi, of course, one of the architects of the war, big booster of the U.S. invasion. He's also been most recently in charge of de-Ba'athification. And some would say that he's been randomly removing former Ba'athist followers of Saddam Hussein as candidates just on a whim. What's the sense of how he's viewed and how that process is viewed?
He is basically in charge of this, what's called the Accountability and Justice Committee. It's the successor organization to the De-Ba'athification Committee. And as you say, it has been barring certain candidates from holding office due to alleged links to Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. Now, there are a few more challenges in the legal pipeline as we speak. What we're hearing is that those challenges are going to go away now, that Mr. Chalabi has said, okay, fine, I'll drop it, I'll let it go. But the whole legal framework upon which this committee works is very questionable indeed. And Mr. Chalabi is an unpredictable man, so we might not have heard the last of this yet.
Well, meanwhile, there is no new government in Iraq. How are people reacting to that?
Yes, there's no new government. The incumbent is still in office. Nouri al-Maliki is still the prime minister. We're, more than 2 months since that election now. I went speaking to a whole bunch of people, English teachers and students at a college in Baghdad, about this very issue, and asking them what their hopes and indeed fears are about this ongoing political stalemate.
You ask about what will happen in the future or what you expect if there is no government. We'll expect more and more and more explosions until we get a miracle from our mighty God to solve these problems.
I think that things will change, I'm sure of it. America, for example, had civil war. Okay, so it's a temporary period. Things will change. The best is yet to come.
Well, that Iraqi woman reminds us that the U.S. didn't recover from its civil war for, some would say, a full century. Right now, there are 92,000 American troops in Iraq. This week, General Odierno was supposed to order the pullout of over 12,000, a process that would continue until September when all combat troops would be gone. 50,000 advisory troops would remain. Does it seem like that drawdown is on hold because of the violence?
I don't think it's on hold. Whether or not they're going to have a look at how quickly they do it or in what kind of batches or stages, I think they may be looking at that because of the violence. But actually, despite Monday's bombing, which was certainly the bloodiest in the year, the violence has been less intense than some people feared it might be, given the political deadlock. I haven't seen a sense that the Americans here are thinking that Iraq is about to descend into full-scale chaos. So I don't think they are looking at a whole-scale revising of that timetable for withdrawal at the moment.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse in Baghdad. Gabriel, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, coming up, a look back at the good old and not so good old days at Newsweek magazine in 30 seconds here and now. Media corporations Thomson Reuters and Bertrand, the company which owns Politico, are said to be interested in buying the once-vaunted Newsweek magazine. Back in the day, competing with its arch-rival Time magazine, Newsweek was famous for capturing the cultural zeitgeist on its weekly cover, but that got a lot harder in the 24/7 media world. Newsweek was put up for sale last week by its current owner, The Washington Post. Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam was an editorial assistant and fact-checker back in the late 70s. When the magazine was in its heyday, he joins us to remember when, quote, being a journalist on the rise was a glass half-filled job. That's the headline on his recent column. And Alex, you mean that quite literally about filling glasses?
It's my job, actually, as the junior member of the Enterprise, was to keep Richard Steele's vodka glass full of both vodka and ice on Friday nights. He was an extremely gifted editor whose hands shook constantly whether he had his vodka or not. And he would literally write this entire edition, the so-called international edition, he would write it at his typewriter on a vodka high that used to go to about 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning.
Well, it wasn't unusual for journalists back in the day to have that bottom drawer with the bottle in it. And your job was in part to keep that glass full. But what else did you do? You're a fact checker.
Right. I mean, there used to be this sort of monumental apparatus that created Time and Newsweek each week. They had correspondents in the field. They had these sort of Ivy League educated editors who would rewrite the correspondents to no great avail. And then they had these generally women, although they started hiring men around the mid-70s, they had these fact checkers who the point of them being women was so they could have affairs with the writers. But there was no real point in them being men. So we would quote unquote, you know, check the copy for accuracy, make sure the names were spelled correctly, and there were even things called red check sources, which were slightly ludicrous, which meant we really checked it.
Well, but there was an attitude that came with the Newsweeklies, and just put it a little in context for us, because you had the Newsweeklies, and as you write, the whole model for Newsweek had been lifted wholesale from Time, but these Newsweeklies were sort of positioned kind of between, the New Yorker, places where writers could really write, and U.S. News and World Report, which had in-depth reporting. These were kind of, especially in Newsweek's case, they were kind of, Newsweek is almost actually more of a precursor to People magazine.
Yeah, there's some truth in that. I mean, although it should not be forgotten that People magazine sprang, you know, full-blown from a single page in Time magazine. They realized it was the only page in Time that anybody's actually reading, so they created a whole weekly magazine called People. I mean, Newsweek, you're right, because back when I was working for Newsweek, and this was quite a long time ago, they couldn't exactly duplicate Time. Time was very serious. Time was for the Vietnam War. Time was kind of your parents' Newsweekly. It was basically boring. So Newsweek their sort of strategic advantage, as they calculated it at least, was to be sort of younger, hipper, less boring. You know, they wrote more about TV, more about Hollywood. In fact, when I was there, the editor got fired, basically, for writing too much about Hollywood. I mean, after all, he reported to Katharine Graham, the then owner of the Washington Post and Newsweek. And you know, Katharine Graham, you know, believed in hard news. I mean, she liked Newsweek circulation. She liked the money Newsweek spun off. But she got tired of Suzanne Somers on the cover, basically, and she fired this guy.
Well, but what about the editorial side? Now, you wrote, you worked with the international arm of Newsweek, but as you write, the entire mission seemed to be refighting the Cold War. And actually, you might publish whole stories that were lies. François Mitterrand's plan to destroy the French economy, a recurring theme. And so, as copy boy, you learned how to spell his name, but was that true?
Yeah, that was true. I mean, what the most vivid, happily, I mean, it's not happily, but the fact is some of these people are no longer alive. But Time was ferocious in its pursuit of anti-communism in the Cold War. Newsweek was certainly not far behind. I mean, I happened to have been working there during Mitterrand's first attempt to take power, which failed. He was running against a conservative named Giscard d'Estaing. And we were so bent on discrediting Mitterrand. We had pretty good circulation in Europe. We were taken pretty seriously there. That we would publish literally anything negative about Mitterrand. But the one event that I do remember all too clearly was when we had written a cover story and the top people felt it sort of wasn't harsh enough on the Socialist Party. So we then took Time magazine's cover story from the previous week and ran it through this guy's typewriter, which of course isn't really considered very ethical journalism.
Well, and there was also the anti-communist crusader, Arnaud de Borchgrave.
Yeah, he's still alive. Arnaud de Borchgrave is very much alive.
Have you heard from him, having written about him in your column?
I haven't, nor from his lawyers, but who knows?
Well, you write he would announce his masterpieces with the antiquated phrase, three bells, which is an old wire service phrase, which isn't needed anymore. And people might laugh at his copy, but print it anyway.
Yeah, he sort of made his bones during the Vietnam War, actually. I believe he was the first American journalist to go to North Vietnam. He actually wore this stuff that you thought foreign correspondents should wear. In fact, all Newsweek foreign correspondents wore those weird kind of safari jackets with notebooks sticking out of them. De Borchgrave was, by the time I got there, considered to be pretty close to a total fraud. But the funniest thing was, of course, this is back in the day when these guys could, at Time and both Time and Newsweek, put amazing expenses on their expense account. And de Borchgrave once sent in an expense account for a rental car from which he had ripped off the driver's side door. This is because he was covering some African revolution. And he said to sort of the editors that you have to rip off the door if you know anything about Africa, because if there's a roadside ambush or bomb, you need to get out of the car very quickly. You don't have time to open the door.
Well, and so, you know, as you say, he made his bones. You got to give him credit for being out there. But Alex Beam, again, a columnist for the Boston Globe, which has had its own struggles, so I'm not sure if you're the one to give advice to Newsweek. However, in just the minute we have left, what would you say to the new owner? Do you want to see it completely revised? Do we need a Newsweek? Can Newsweek compete in an online world?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, there is an analogy to the Boston Globe in the sense that you have the amazing equity in the name. You know, the name is worth so much. Now they've sort of stripped it down to a kind of economist wannabe. You know, it's sort of economist for dummies. I'm not certain that's going to be working out too well for them.
Well, we'll keep an eye on Newsweek. And Alex Beam, thanks for helping us look back at Newsweek past. Alex Beam, again, with the Boston Globe. Thank you.
Robin, thank you.
And again, a reminder, tomorrow, author Michael Lewis, that's your reading assignment, his new book, The Big Short. If you haven't read it yet, pick it up, and we'll be talking to him tomorrow. Also, we'll touch down in China, another attack on school children this week. That's tomorrow. Back in a minute, here and now. Sue Miller's new novel poses an almost obscene thought. It's unimaginable it would be raised even a few years ago. What if, like Miller's character Wilhelmina, who's called Billy, you had a boyfriend killed on 9/11 and your strongest emotion was relief.
Of course she would remember him. She would remember good things about him, as well as the trapped feelings she'd slowly come to have living with him. She would remember him perhaps longer and with more pain than someone whose feelings were less ambivalent, less knotted. She would remember him every time she walked the dog, every time she saw an airplane glide through an azure sky, every September 11th of her life. She swore to herself she would. She would remember him, she was sure, long after she'd forgotten exactly what he looked like or exactly why she'd felt she couldn't live with him anymore.
Of course, Billy can't share her feelings with anyone, especially the sister of her lover, Gus, who's cast Billy as the grieving girlfriend, assuming Billy's pain matches her own. But Billy is a playwright, so ultimately her true feelings bleed out into a play. It's called The Lakeshore Limited, which is also the name of the novel, and author Sue Miller joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Boy, what made you even think of this angle about 9/11?
I'd had a young friend, college age, who stayed with her college-age boyfriend for a full year after September, a full college year, which is an eternity to a college kid, though she had been about to end things with him because his sister died on 9/11. Mm. And I began to sort of think about that situation and conjured my character, Billy, out of that. What if you were about to break up with the person and essentially were called upon to sort of enact feelings you didn't have and felt you should because of your relationship to other people in this person's life? That's what started me. A lot of other things sustained me over the few years it took to write it, but that's what got me going.
Boy, I'll say, because it goes in all directions, but it's interesting because, you know, I said Gus, the boyfriend, has a sister, Leslie. She has cast Billy as this, you know, bereaved girlfriend. So Billy's playing a role, mm-hmm. you know, that really isn't her, and she's a playwright mm-hmm. who also then turns around and writes this play about a fictional terrorist train bombing at Chicago's Union Station. This becomes a stand-in, we see quickly, for her own pain. What are you saying, though, about Billy? Is that a bad person?
Relief isn't the only thing she feels, actually. She's genuinely grief-stricken for Gus. I mean, she has grief. But it's simply not the kind of grief that she's expected to feel. I actually read a very interesting graphic novel, not novel, but graphic memoir of the events of 9/11 written by the widow of someone who died. And she'd actually been very angry at him when he died. And it was compelling to me as I read it because it's so kind of connected to the feelings that Billy has, like sort of complicated, not right feelings that Billy has. But I think, you know, anyone in a sort of complicated human situation with another person could find themselves in this situation.
Well, it's interesting. There's a play within the play, and then there's all of these people who gather to watch the play and mm-hmm. all these other supposedly real characters who walk into your novel. And many of them also have ambivalent feelings about loved ones or complicated relationships mm-hmm. with loved ones. Mm-hmm. Rafe, who plays the lead in the play, in his life, he has a wife who has a terrible illness. Sam has a wife who died of breast cancer, and he was left raising several boys, and he didn't do a very good job at it.
I think that life imposes a lot of painful situations on people in which they're required to behave rather better than they would like to behave. I mean, I'm sure we've all, well, most people of a certain age anyway, have been through that. You know, my father died of Alzheimer's disease, and I was sort of his caregiver in the late stages of things, although he was in a very good place. But I was the person responsible for him. And, you know, felt anger at him sometimes in a way that it was so unfair. And I knew it was unfair, but it's what I felt. And I think people do feel a sort of an impatience and anger that's hard to forgive yourself for afterwards. And so some of what I was doing with these various characters who have very complicated lives and histories is to sort of look at the way the play and the situation that Billy presents in the play, which comes out of her life, connects to their lives and the way in which they see that or don't see that.
So there's a play within the play, but there's also a way of treating the characters who are outside the play in the novel as if they're in a play. As we were saying, Billy's cast in something. And I found myself noting how many times you might describe a building as being a bunch of sets. Apartments in an old brick house look like so many stage sets, characters visible in each. At one point, the character Sam parks his car outside a house and watches Gus's sister Leslie and her husband through these open windows. She's cooking, he's reading, And it feels, again, like another staged play.
Mm-hmm. Even at that moment when Sam is looking at Leslie and her husband, he's thought about coming in.
Entering
stage left, right. As he says it, and he decides not to. There just were a lot of ways in which I was able, I mean, in part because I was obviously working with the theater in this book, but able to employ that kind of imagery, which was one of the pleasures of writing the book.
Well, do you write stage plays? Because a large part of the book is watching as these characters, these actors, try to figure out who their characters are. There's a director, there's a playwright working with them, and it's, you know, we see them. And I wonder if that's what happens for Sue Miller with her characters. Is she trying to get them to flesh themselves out to her, too? I mean,
I certainly act them. I mean, I say their lines aloud. I make sure that I hear them a certain way in my own head and write them and then say them aloud. And I actually read this book on tape, so I got the chance to play them. But I think that's one of the real pleasures of writing for me is the sort of, you know, it's like playing with dolls. You know, he'll say this and then she'll say that back to him. And you sort of, you know, say, oh, no, he wouldn't say that. He would say this. And, you know, that's revision, of course.
But by the way, for our listeners, you were just, as we all did as kids, you were holding one doll in one hand and another doll in the other hand as they talk to each other.
Yeah. You know, I enjoy writing dialogue, and I enjoy situations in which sort of complicated things are happening as people talk to each other. They're sort of missing the connection. Each person has his own sort of understanding of what's being exchanged. Those kinds of things, to me, are just great fun to write, very interesting to write.
Well, you said that in addition to 9/11, other things propelled you, sustained you.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the other things, if I could ask?
Just the theater. I mean, I went and sat in on a lot of on a play that was being produced in. I was living in California for that semester, teaching out there, and it was a play at a little theater in Berkeley, and sort of learned about that, which was really a pleasure. I mean, you know, so much of writing is sort of solitary. It's nice when you sort of go out in the world to learn something about some aspect of a book that you're working on.
Researching. What are you saying about age? Because a couple of these characters, not Billy, she's got a few more chances, but there are a couple of characters, decisions they make, that's going to be it for like, you know, maybe the last 10, 15 years of their life. Mm-hmm. They're older. The couple that seemed the least sort of, you know, wow, I think they're going to split up by the end of this book. It turns out at the end of the book, they have the best sex of everybody.
It was interesting to sort of, I mean, in a way, the book is a series of love stories. As much as it's an exploration of this play and the way it affects people and the way grief affects people, it really is a way of looking at four different kinds of, or even more, I think, kinds of love and the way people have lasted with them or turned away from them or had them end through death or are waiting for death to end them to see what comes next. But it seemed to me to be, in most ways, an affirmative book around those issues. I mean, certainly there are mistakes people have made and bad things have happened. But I think in the end, you sort of get to see what sustains each of these couples.
Sue Miller, her latest novel is The Lakeshore Limited. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much. It was fun.